Very rarely, but interestingly, one of the things that I do with the students here is actually ask them which writers they'd like to have as part of the series. Now, inevitably, they come up with things like Sylvia Plath or whatever, or the usual one, Seamus Heaney. And I'm sure that Seamus will indeed come one day, and Plath might come in some sort of spirit. But the name that came top of the list last autumn was, in fact, John Burnside. So, in fact, you were nominated by the young, which I think may say something about your future. It's actually 5 years since John and I met. The way that we met was rather unusual, is that we were both interviewed for a fellowship in writing at the University of Dundee, which is was a very arch and strange affair, chiefly because during my interview, and I was being interviewed by 15 people, the then chair of the literature panel of the Scottish Arts Council addressed me throughout the interview as Mr. Burnside. Now, I'm delighted to say, and I'm very pleased to say, that actually John did get the job, and I got the train home to the north of England.
It wasn't really me who got it.
and almost upon the rebound from Dundee, what I then did was I immediately applied for a fellowship in writing at the University of Warwick, and I've been here ever since. John now teaches creative writing at the University of St Andrews, to which some of our students have gone, and it's a very fine programme. Now, I think his poetry is, John's work is outstanding, and his novels are essential. And before we pass on to John, I'd just like to make a little advert. If you take your tickets for Writers at Warwick immediately after this event to the bookshop, you can in fact get 10% off academic texts, or better still, 20% off works of fiction. Now, I've checked with the bookshop, and they do have a merry pile of John's novels there, copies of The Mercy Boys and The Dumb House. They're on the right, just as you go in. So grab a copy, £5.95, minus 20%, mind, and bring it back after the reading to be signed. We did actually order copies of John's books of poetry. They ordered some, and they sold out before the event, which is, again, a good sign. But they do have copies of Penguin Modern Poets, which features John Burnside, Robert Crawford and Kathleen Jamie, which you can also get on the ticket too, and presents a very fine and good selection of John's poetry. I shall stop there. Ladies and gentlemen, John Burnside.
I just realised there's no clock in here.
There's one just behind you.
I lost my wristwatch the day before. I had to travel all over doing readings, and I like to. It isn't actually that I need to time myself reading. It's just that I feel reassured as I watch time passing that the pain of actually standing here reading will soon be over. For all of us, and I also have found that there has been one phenomenon that still surprises me, is that a poem that I know takes 2 minutes to read sometimes takes 5 minutes, and I have no idea why. But then somebody I know who doesn't like poetry particularly came to a reading of mine and sat in the audience and came up to me afterwards and said, I know the explanation for that. It's because you ramble on before you read anything. And you probably talk for about 4 minutes about the poem, and the poem lasts for about 30 seconds. So I'll try to do that. That's it, so. It makes me sound like an Irish poet. It's always more charming than a Scottish poet, have you noticed? All the Irish poets are very charming and very entertaining as well. You go to an Irish poet's reading and you can hear the audience laughing a lot. And in a Scottish poet's reading, it's usually someone snuffling at the back. Usually their partner or someone. The first poem's a love poem, so it's already getting more upbeat all the time. And I've called it Blues. And it's actually in three parts. It's moments like this When the barman goes through the back and leaves me alone, a radio whispering somewhere amongst the glasses, I'm through with love. The way the traffic slows to nothing, how all of a sudden at 3 in the afternoon, the evening's already begun, a nascent dimming. By 10, I'll be walking away on Union Street or crossing Commercial Road in a gust of rain, and everyone who passes will be you, or almost you, before it's someone else. Or how I feel tonight, abandoned, stilled, aware of every nerve, of every pinpoint of fatigue and nursed ascent, encrypted angels dangling in the blood, acidic singularities of fire. The way I'm emptied for every and no good reason, becalmed, and absurdly expert in the art of boiling a kettle or raising a cup to my mouth. Well, at night I'd been traveling for hours on a slow-moving train, snow on the open fields, the whiteness glimmering mile after mile like a child's impression of infinity, the odd wavering bend in the road, and a single mint-colored lamp for gas or a roadside bar. I was halfway to sleep, or perhaps I had slept unawares, then started awake when the train pulled into the station and didn't move on. And though I was waiting to ask, no one came to explain, and I sat there for hours with my face to the ice-cold glass, the window's half-reflection, half some vaguely good-humoured notion of dissolve, the place name on the signpost almost gone, some local or native word for hopelessly lost. Or how I keep thinking of nowhere and meaning you, spaces you might inhabit as the light inhabits doors or windows or the bright membrane of yolk and milk on the kitchen table. The way a sound, this music, or the owl's night-long to and fro of lulls and cries rests in the mind for years like a childhood dream. Whatever remains unfinished, the not pursued, each glimmer on the cusp of touch or loss. I actually like reading new poems most, so if you don't mind, I'll indulge. Although I've got a new book out now, I've only got one copy of myself, but I believe others do exist. I have one copy which has actually been chewed by my neighbour's cat, and that's the only one I've actually seen in the flesh, as it were, but I believe that others do exist. I like to read poems that are absolutely new. And the thing is, when we have a production cycle of a book that comes out this year, everybody thinks that it's new because they haven't seen it before, and I've been living with those poems for maybe a year or more, sometimes 2-3 years. So they don't have the same freshness as the new ones, which hopefully will. This is a new poem. I've actually been writing a lot of poems about animals recently. And I used to think that people shouldn't write poems about animals because of all the other things we do to them, but I've become more kind of able to do that now, and the kind of underlying theme is Orpheus and his relationship with the animal world. And if you know the myth about Orpheus, the other myth, not the one about Eurydice, where Orpheus could sing creatures into being, and Orpheus spoke his poems or sang his poems, he could create new life forms, new things would come into being just by the existence of the poem, as it were. And I like that idea. It makes me feel I'm not actually wasting my time doing all this thing. Maybe something will actually happen eventually. I'll kind of turn around in my study and there'll be a mink or something in the corner. I've always wanted a pet, so it might work. Animals. There are nights when we cannot name the animals that flit across our headlights. Even on moonlit journeys when the road is eerie and still, and we smell the water long before the coast road or those lamps across the bay. They cross our path, unnameable and bright as any in the sudden heat of Eden. Mostly it's rabbit or fox, though we sometimes caught a ghost of powder blue or Chinese white, or chanced upon a mystery of eyes and passed the last few miles in wonderment. It's like the time our only neighbour died on Echo Road, leaving our house unoccupied for months, a darkness at the far end of the track that set itself apart, the emptied stairwell brooding in the heat, the blank rooms filling with scats and the dreams of mice. In time, we came to think that house contained a presence. We could see it from the yard, shifting from room to room in the autumn rain, and we thought it was watching us, a kindred shape, more animal than ghost. They say if you dream an animal, it means the self, that mess of memory and fear which wants, remembers, understands, denies. And even now, we sometimes wake from dreams of moving from room to room with its scent on our hands and a slickness of musk and fur on our sleep-washed skins. Yet what I sense in this and cannot tell is not the continuity we understand as self, but life, beyond the life we live on purpose, one broad presence that proceeds by craft and guesswork, shadowing our love. I want to go step back one book to just to contradict everything I said about reading old poems, to a poem from a previous book called A Normal Skin, which came out a while ago. And it includes a series of eight poems which I wrote as an epithalamium. And just to explain, in case anybody doesn't know what an epithalamium is, it's a poem in praise of marriage. And usually what happens is if people are getting married, one of their friends writes a poem to the happy couple to celebrate marriage, you know, to say good things about marriage for them. That's what it's to try and encourage them to keep going. And I would have liked this to happen, but I don't have that many friends, and certainly none that can actually write anything that's vaguely good English. So I wrote it myself. Not that that's any more of a recommendation, but it was either that or nothing. And it was an eight-part poem, as I say, and it's supposed to, as it were, praise marriage, and I gave it to my wife as a wedding gift. And she said, oh, great. And the second poem in the series of eight, remember it's supposed to get better as time goes by, the second poem is about a man who leaves home in his shirt sleeves and never comes home, never comes back again. You know, there's the old stories about people going out for the bread, saying, I'm just going out for the bread, dear, and see you in 15 minutes. And they go out the door and they never come back. My favorite fantasy, actually. But I won't read that one because I think that's even a little bit too depressing. But this is the first one in the series, and I think you'll, from hearing it, maybe get the general impression that she might have been disappointed. And it's called Shekinah, which is supposed to be the presence of the angel, or a kind of divine presence on earth. But it's represented in a painting by an angel hovering over a marriage bed, which seemed a good starting place, really, for a poem about marriage. Shekinah. I've heard how the trawlermen harvest quivering, sexless fish from the ache of the sea, how they stand on the lighted decks and hold the clouded bodies, watching the absence form in those buttoned eyes and thinking of their children home in bed, their songless wives made strange by years of dreaming. I've heard that seal folk drift in from the hearth through open doors, the cold that strokes your lips while I am gone, probing your sleep and stealing a little warmth to mimic love. So driving back, it's always a surprise that coming home is only to the given. Old gardens in Loch Galley, thick with privet, still pools of oil and salt at Pitt and Weem, lights on the Isle of May, the low woods filling with salted rain beyond Markinch. It's always a surprise, the stink of neeps, the malt spills of autumn fields where floodlit tractors labour and churn, the last few miles of wind and scudding clouds or starlit silence hung around the house, as vivid as the angel who attends all marriages. Its shimmer on our bed is subtle, but it keeps us to itself, learning the make-believe of granted love. And this is all we know, an angel's gift, that weddings are imagined, love's contrived while each of us has one more tale to tell. the way you feel the turning of the tide beneath the house or somewhere in the roof, or how I sometimes linger on the stairs, listening for nothing, unconvinced, less husband than accomplice to the dark, beguiled by the pool of the moon and the ley lines of herring. Which one? Well, it's not often I get requests, other than to leave, of course. So, yeah, of course. I'd be happy to. The last poem in the book is called Penitence, which is the kind of state I find myself in often. And again, it's got an animal in it, actually. This is the stage at which I found I was interested in writing about animals. But this is made up, really. So if anybody's kind of getting worried, no animals were actually killed during the making of the poem, or even badly injured. But it did happen to me in Northern California. I'm a very bad driver, and you don't need to take my word on it. My wife will tell you, and several people have been in my car and have lived to tell the tale, but they're not quite sure how. And so I'm not very attentive, and I used to go on long highway drives when I was in the U.S. and I used to work in California sometimes, and I kind of, forget that I was driving, because you do, there's long straight roads, and you say, well, okay, fine, just keep going. And start thinking about other things, and an animal came darting out, as they do, a small deer, actually, luckily. And I almost hit it, but I kind of swerved, and the animal swerved, luckily, the other direction, it's not always what happens, and I missed it. And then I heard another story from another friend about a deer he'd hit. So I kind of put the stories together and pretend that it was me. Penitence. I was driving into the wind on a northern road, the redwoods swaying around me like a black ocean. I drifted off. I didn't see the deer till it bounced away, the back legs swinging outwards as I braked and swerved into the tinder of the verge. As soon as I stopped, the headlamps filled with moths, and something beyond the trees was tuning in, a hard attention boring through my flesh to stroke the bone. That shudder took so long to end, I thought the animal had slipped beneath the wheels and lay there quivering. I left the engine running, stepped outside. Away at the edge of the light, a body shifted amongst the leaves, and I wanted to go, to help, to make it well. Every step I took pushed it away. Or no, that's not the truth, or all the truth. Now I admit my own fear held me back, not fear of the dark or that presence bending the trees, not even fear exactly, but the dread of touching, of colliding with that pain. I stood there in the river of the wind for minutes, then I walked back to the car and drove away. I want to think that deer survived, or if it died, it slipped into the blackness unawares. But now and then I drive out to the woods and park the car. The headlamps fill with moths. The woods tune in. I listen to the night and hear an echo fading through the trees. My own flesh and the body of the deer still resonant, remembered through the fender. Now, I have to watch out what I say now. I wrote this poem, and I tried reading it in Glasgow, and my rather thoughtless preface to the poem, reading of the poem, was to say that I thought that Scottish men needed the men's movement, and what I meant was that we're all so screwed up, we should start doing something about ourselves before it's all too late. But the whole audience, literally every single person in the audience, took it exactly the opposite, that I thought Scottish men needed some kind of, I don't know, PR unit to go around saying how great they were. And there's a movement called the Scottish Men's Movement, which goes around saying things like, men are great. And, the only reason that we've got problems is because, all the old traditional roles that we used to fulfill have been taken away from us. And I didn't know this, call me naive or what, But everybody in the audience looked at me and glowered at me for the rest of the reading, because I read it quite early in the evening. And they were all hating me a little more than usual, especially the women, which isn't that rare. But and then literally people were glowering at me, and I was feeling more and more uncomfortable. And eventually I plucked up my courage when people were asking questions after, and said, "Can I ask you why you all felt so unhappy with that poem?" And then someone explained it to me. So I don't think that Scottish men are the men's movement, but I wrote this poem because I thought, isn't it odd that men, you know, Scottish men are terribly screwed up. I mean, I don't think there are any Scottish men in the audience, though. It's just me. Well, I can tell you I'm a good example. You know, I have a lot of conversations with male friends and with female friends about why this is the case, you know. And we come to various conclusions. And I was walking in my harbour where I live one day, and I saw the men teaching their sons how to fish. They only teach their sons, they don't teach their daughters, unfortunately, but it might come. But I noticed one thing in between them was the inability to actually say anything in words that bestowed affection or warmth or kindness. You know? So it was like gruffly saying, "No, not like that." You know, that kind of Scottish thing. You know? "That's wrong." Which I realized was the way my father tried to, when he did try to occasionally express affection for me, was by, you know, shouting things like, "Stand up straight, yeah," you know, and that kind of stuff. Because he couldn't do anything else, apparently. So I thought, wouldn't it be a nice start for men to be able to communicate with their children the skills they have, for example. Because I live in a fishing village, and all the men, most of the men anyway, over a certain age, had worked in the fishing at one time and lost that. And it was taken away from them, and it's true. There is a sense that something's been taken away. And it'd be nice if they could pass it on to other people. So this is a poem. It's an incredibly long introduction. But anyway, this is a poem about not having a men's movement. It's called The Men's Harbour. The eider are back. Formal as decoys, they sit at the end of the quay in the day's first warmth. Sunday, when the townsmen bring their sons to fish off the dock, their rods propped by the wall, the tense lines streaming with light. The boys in hats and scarves and brightly coloured anoraks, the men sober, reflective, wrapped in the quiet of work that is theirs for once and unaccountable. And I can't help but think there is something they want to pass on, a knowledge they can't quite voice, though it has to do with the grace that distinguishes strength from power. Beyond the quay, a crew of gulls is shredding refuse sacks for morsels of fishbone, choice oozings of yogurt or mango. They half cooperate, half vie with one another, butting in for fatter scraps and fluttering away, tracking the tarmac with newsprint and crusted grease. There's nothing elegant in this, no special skill, nothing save luck and speed and the odd flutter of threat, a clownish, loud bravado. Further upshore, the sun finds the white on white of the caravan park. Blisters of paint and distemper flaking away from brickwork and metal. Alleys of half-kept garden between the stands. The scalped grass dusted with frost. A single blackbird scratching for grubs in the dirt of the island bed. Someone has set a flag above the dock. A thin old man in a jerkin and fingerless gloves mending a hull. His tight lips crammed with nails, his eyes like shells. And others here are working on their dreams of water, men in overalls or coats or muddled sweaters, scrabbed with paint and rust. Their hands are dark with oil or coiled in rope, the bodies subtle, verging on the edge of weightlessness. No law to hold them here, no harbored rage. This is the life they want, their chosen craft, working with hooks and chains through the seawater cold. Each of them knows what it is to have been refused, to feel the silence swelling in their throats, and nothing to be said, lest they admit how little they care for anything but this, wanting a life that stays untraceable. Each of them knows, and each of them makes his peace, the burden of a given name and place discarded in the moment's self-forgetting. They're out at the rim of navigable space and ready for something no one could explain. A mystery to fathom when it comes, like starlight or a music in the tide or some new vessel coming in to land one cold, bright afternoon. Some unknown craft with snow on the deck or a phantom of morning lamplight sealed in the hull's bright paint like the spirit of tungsten. I want to jump to two poems that are new again. I actually wanted to be a taxonomist at one time. I found the idea of classifying everything really interesting for some reason. And I keep returning to that theme in writing in different ways. The whole idea of classification and naming the world and what benefits that brings and what we lose by doing it. And also the desire to connect with the world. Connect the natural world in a way that somehow seems missing from my life anyway. I feel a kind of homesickness for the other animals, I suppose. And again, it goes back to that kind of Orphic thing that I was mentioning before, this kind of idea that Orpheus found some way of making a connection with the animal world. So I decided to write two poems about taxonomy, and there was something missing from the way I was thinking about it. And a friend of mine came over from the US to do a reading in St. Andrews for us, and her name's Linda Gregerson. She's a very fine American poet. And we were talking about things and realized what I realized during the conversation while we were talking about something completely different about work she'd been doing, that what was missing for me was trying to convey the affection in naming that naming must have begun with affection. That if Adam went out with a list, a piece of paper and a pencil, and God said, go out and name all those animals, he couldn't have thought of any names until he started loving them. That was my kind of basic starting point. And the Orphic myth has more resonance for me for that reason, because obviously you sing about things that you love. So I felt as though Orpheus was the one who had this kind of nostalgia for the other animals. So it's kind of an Orphic poem about taxonomy, but it's in two parts. And I called the first one Flora. And I thought long and hard about the title for the second one. And I came up with something I think is quite good, but I'll tell you that when I read that one. Flora is the first. Because it can only be shared like a waltz or a trust, this commonplace affection singles out a hair streak or the pattern on a leaf, leaving the rest untold, the world unspoken. And though we mostly look for what we know, there is something we love in ourselves that a meadow answers, the blue of an upland flower or a tideline of grass, the heart-shaped or spatulate leaf of toadflax or fern. The color is nothing like bays or polished jade, the gap between colt's foot and mint no more or less specific than a kale field in the rain, but looking always work towards a word, trading the limits of speech for the unsaid presence. The way the bird that vanished through the leaves is true forever now, being unseen. And the magic that speech performs is all continuum, the given and the named discovered and invented one more time, with each new bud or tendril that unfolds upon the revelation of the known. And quite surprisingly for me, it took only a few days to get the second title for the second poem, which is Fauna. Once we are close enough to give them names, we cannot help but treat them as our own, these animals. Though they are far from us, and wrapped in other frequencies like waves or stars, we speak as if they understood the words, as if this fondness were the only language. They say in the earliest myth, before the descent, our father Orpheus would sometimes charm new creatures from the air, musk ox and deer pressed into life and ringed about with song. I always think of them as privileged, enchanted by the intimate surprise of other bodies. Yet they might have been uncertain of the presence they possessed, the fresh light singling them out like revenants as they took form and shaped a chiming world. It's difficult not to think in déjà vu when everything seems so familiar. Wisteria, lilac, the century plant in bloom like a pillar of salt. Difficult not to believe we might go down amongst the shadows, stealing love from time and coming home to where the song begins, as if this world were nothing but a gap, the afterlife of dust and locust trees we used to imagine in school, or the cursive space where one form is abandoned for the next, the old flesh invested with snow and the taste of currants, the old regrets and loves becoming tendons, milk teeth, misted fingerprints. The other philosopher that I've got really interested in is Lucretius. And I suppose being a poet, one doesn't have the rigor to be a philosopher, really. I don't even have the rigor to be a poet. What I do is try and convince myself that I'm actually engaged with something really philosophical. So I write poems with the title stolen from philosophers. So I have one called Being in Time, which is only one page long. So it at least has the brevity to recommend it. And this poem is actually called The Nature of Things, which is, any of your philosophy fans here will know, is taken from Lucretius' long poem, very long poem. And it's only one page long too, so think of me in a way as a kind of condenser of very long philosophical pieces of writing, and it might work that way. This is The Nature of Things. Because some animals are nameless, wed to the fabric of things and tentative as new snow or a spill of water drops evaporating on the kitchen floor, we think this house is empty when we leave for work or school, forgetting the wisps of breath in the lath and plaster, the heartbeat in the downpipe, something faint or newborn in the distance under stairs. Something like blood vein, perhaps, of the life we've almost imagined for sea hares and caddisflies. A presence we might envisage like a sign bearing a partial resemblance to redpole or mink, but scarcely perceptible, lacking in color and scent. And this is why we struggle to describe the angels who will occupy these rooms while we are gone, finding our lonely possessions, our fruit bowls and spoons, our empty raincoats hanging by the door, the newspaper pinned by a cup to the kitchen table. This is why we furnish them with wings and human skin, their bodies clenched in song, silent as milk and naked as the rain. I had to write a poem for a science conference. I was invited to be the writer in residence at the science conference. And the only science that I know in any way, any kind of real way, is mathematical, I suppose. I used to work in the computer industry, and I couldn't really figure a way of writing a poem about mathematics. I couldn't. But one character from science had stuck in my mind is a man called John Goodrick, who was an astronomer and a mathematician. And he was deaf, completely deaf. And I had this image of him. He used to go out and sit at night and stare at the stars all night, gaze at the stars all night with his small telescope. And I had this image of him kind of tuning into the stars and maybe hearing the music of the spheres. John Goodrick lived from 1764 to 1786. So he didn't live very long, 22 years, but in that time he made some important contributions to astronomy. And one of the reasons why he died was he went out all night in a Yorkshire field and sat out all night looking at the stars, and he got ill because of that and later died. And the problem's called sense data. We measured things for years. Our schoolroom walls, the growth of plants, lost energy, shed skins. We counted petals, tadpoles, grains of sand, observed migrations, rainfalls, frequencies. I thought there was a chromatography for happiness or unrequited love. And somewhere behind it all, in private realms of gulls' eggs and stones and things I couldn't name, another world of charge and borderline, an earth tied in the spine, the night-long guesswork of old voices in the mind. Waking at night, I would sneak downstairs in the dark and know my way by some unconscious craft, some seventh sense that recognized a deeper pulse, the tug of things at rest, the tension in a table or a vase of goldenrod. When I stood outside, head tilted to a night sky packed with light, I waited for a music I could feel like motion in the marrow of my bones, as Goodrick must have done, night after night, beyond all hearing, resonant as some struck bell, harmonic singing in his blood, his fingertips and eyelids bruised with grace, and tuned into the plain song of the stars. I'm going to do two more. The next to last is my favorite fairy story, and I keep retelling it all the time. And it's the one about the princess and the golden ball and the frog. And there's no prizes for guessing who I am in this poem. I would make a very poor princess. But I've always felt a huge affection for this frog. I just love this frog and feel as though one day I'll write a poem which even remotely corresponds to how lovable this frog actually is. So this is called A Golden Ball. I think if anything comes close to perfect, it's the solitude of frogs, or dormant fish in ruffled sleeves of ice, corroded by a dream of summer. This is why they can talk in fairy stories, wiser than the birds who come and go and only ever tell of distance, like a singing in the wires along a desert highway or a moonlit ghost town. Imagine what remains to be revealed in films of mud and duckweed, while the transformation waits to happen, how there really is a life that comes from nowhere, neither egg nor spawn, but something in the stitchwork of a thaw, becoming flesh and offering its kiss. And the last poem I want to read is one that totally mystifies me, and I've read it about three times now to other people. Poor guinea pigs like yourself, in other words. And each time I do it, I feel as though I might understand something about it, but I don't really. But it also it was born, as it were, in that realm of fairy stories and such things. But the original title for it was, and I'm not going to explain this because I don't think I've got time to even begin to try and explain why it was the original title, was L'Entre Monde. And A, it felt pretentious to have a French title. And B, I'm still not sure I understand what L'Entre Monde means. So I decided to call it Otherwise in English. And the old sense of otherwise is roots, you know, otherwise, as in other knowledge or other awareness. And hopefully that works. And I see on this page, I've actually been typing it out in various forms. I've actually got both titles, Otherwise, L'Entre Monde, which wasn't what I intended, but anyway. But somewhere it'll begin to make sense as a poem, other than the music, which I think musically it seems to work for me. So I think that's all one can hope for. So I'll finish with this one. Otherwise. In all those childhood tales of transformation, of huntsmen turned to ice or pools of blood, or dreaming girls awakened with a kiss becoming apple trees or gone into the shapes of seals. In all those stories, we would tell around a fire or gathered in the dark. Isn't the best the one where the children find a borderline between their mother's world and somewhere else? A hidden cave, perhaps, or some enchanted house beside the sea where spirits walk in clouds of song and light, and blue is something tangible like snow. We've been there once or twice, I think, by now, moving from room to room or walking out together in a dawn sky packed with stars. And even if we never turn again to where our echoes wait amongst the leaves, we know the lines to cross, the hidden tracks that sing beneath the holly breaks and springs. And even if we stay within these bounds for years, between the dance hall and the kirk, or sit indoors while snow falls on the woods a mile away, we know that someone else will pick the story up where we left off and go on speaking softly to the air. Thanks.
Thank you, John. It's a strange thing sometimes that after these events, nothing comes so close to perfect, I think, than the solitude of poets. And I feel almost it's sometimes an intrusion to go on into a conversation after a reading in which silence finds such a space. But I'm going to soldier on with my questions and then throw them out to you, as this is what we do here at Warwick. So my first question is simply one about music. Mandelstam, before he wrote a word down, a word hear the music of the poem in his head. Wordsworth, march up and down, generating the music of the poem. You finished upon a poem for which I very much empathise with what you said, you felt that the music was, if you like, right. The words might indeed mystify even the writer. Do you begin with music, or do you begin with sense? How does that all begin with you as a process?
Well, it's really difficult to talk about that in a way without sounding. We live in a time when it's not fashionable to think in certain terms, and certainly to refer to one's poetry in any way and use the word Orphic, you know, or Orpheus or something is pretty bad to begin with. But to talk about the way the poem originates for me anyway is the music, as it were, comes first before, as it were, me. I kind of feel as though I tune into something which is independent of me, and I don't want to make some kind of great claim for inspiration or anything like that. But because I think it's actually the opposite of that. Inspiration, the traditional idea of inspiration, somehow aggrandizes the poet, as if the poet was some kind of special, heroic person. And I can't think of anybody less special or heroic than myself, to be honest. And that for some freak chance, I feel as though something, I tune into something which begins something going. And it, as far as possible, it keeps a life of its own as opposed to being interfered with by me. It works. So I'd always trust that music, finally, mm-hmm. as well. I have other poems that I've published which, you know, if I was paraphrasing, I'd get worried. But the music seems to carry them along and it works. Mm-hmm. And Robert Frost said, the job of a poet is to not stand in the way of the poem. The poem should just come, you know, it sounds like channeling and stuff, doesn't it? But
when did that first start to happen? Because I find that's something, if you like, that comes through, if you like, huge reading, huge listening, and huge practice to develop an ear in that way. Mm. When did you first start to feel that you could hear that?
I used to work in the computer industry. Mm. It's really strange because it's probably the most unlikely answer, but it's true. I actually started because I wanted to paint. I couldn't paint very well. And I also played music in those days, but I don't anymore. But I was interested in all of the arts and just was a very keen consumer, as it were, of most of art form and film and stuff. Mm. And I think I forgot about it when I entered the computer industry. And I quite enjoyed computer work for a long time. And I think maybe something distracted me from thinking of myself in terms of doing something.
what actually happened there? Because I was looking at that career today. It's a career of 6 years. You were a software
10 actually.
You were a software engineer for enterprise systems, 1988 to 1990, and then knowledge engineer for Syntelligence, 1994. And next thing, you're a new generation poet. How did your IT people and your colleagues take that? In the same way that Wallace Stevens sometimes used to say in his insurance office, "I hope the boys at the office don't read that book."
I didn't tell anybody that I was writing poetry. I mean, and surprisingly enough, I don't know why this happened, but nobody in the office noticed that I had books up. I'm not saying that computer people aren't literate in poetry, but just, you know, that poetry work. The strange thing was, I went to the US to do some work, and the office that I worked in, as somebody who worked in the office had found out that I was a poet and started asking me, and they actually asked me to do a reading or something in the office. Kind of nice thing to do. And I did that because I felt very much more relaxed, actually. I felt more relaxed than my US colleagues and my British colleagues generally, actually. But then when that all kind of came back across the water, and people started taking an interest, and I was quite surprised. I was quite pleasantly surprised the fact that they I think you just saw me as this weirdo anyway. But that was...
You were a knowledge engineer.
Yeah, it was.
In every sense.
There were four or five other knowledge engineers in Britain at the time as well. Mm-hmm. And they're all weird, actually. But I think it just was an extension of my weirdness into an area they just didn't want to follow, but they thought it was kind of cute. You know?
Actually. Okay. It's the same as actually trying to write code.
Yeah.
From my experience.
Not so well paid.
It's not so well paid unless people read it. Mm-hmm. I'd like to, without trying to escape any definitions or make any definitions, name a few names. Michael Ondaatje, Vikram Seth, Adam Thorpe, Helen Dunmore, Glyn Maxwell, Stephen Knight, Alan Hollinghurst, and even briefly Andrew Motion. All these poets moving into the novel, moving into the fictive forms. What made up your mind for you there? How did you run across into that? Glyn Hughes is on record as saying, I think once, that his first two books of poems came out, small press work, receives a very small audience, and he wrote the novels that made his name. In order to make money and actually win some readers. Mm. Where did the impulse of prose come from? The impulse of fictional prose?
Yeah, I had an idea for a story which I, when I was still working, and I probably would have written a lot earlier, because it came out of my interest in things to do with naming and taxonomy and language and stuff. And I didn't have time. I mean, you know, I was working a full-time job in computing, which it was... quite difficult. Well, it wasn't difficult. I mean, actually, it's always romanticized how difficult computing is. But one had to keep up with things that were changing a lot. So I actually didn't have a lot of time for, you know, like going to hear the poets read and even reading often. So I had to keep up with. I used to go to conferences and stuff and read papers and things. So, you know, I was fully immersed in that. When I took the plunge and left, one of the reasons I did it was because I wanted to also to write this novel. A novel originally began with these interests, which were mainly to do, as I say, with language and classification and the idea of the soul. And then I put together this story, and I had no idea where this rather vicious and unpleasant story came from. But as I was putting together the vehicle, as it were, for the stuff, I mean, I'll admit it quite happily, all I was really interested in doing was exploring the philosophical ideas that were in my head about, you know, in fictional form. And then this story came out, and I realized afterwards that the story was playing all kinds of personal stuff. And it was based on anything that I'd ever done in my life, pretty well. So I put this piece of fiction together, and this novel came out, and I thought it would, you know, be a literary novel, and 8 people would read it. And it came out, and it did quite well, you know, and it sold quite a lot, and people used to cross the street to avoid me. You know, I went to do a reading, and it was... continuing education group, and it had been prescribed reading, and the number was called Dumb House, by the way, it's available in the shops, I believe, but it had been prescribed for this group of people who, you know, as was often the case, all sat there and glowered at me all the way through this reading that I did from the book.
Not here.
No, you seem quite friendly. I'm sure something will happen later to disabuse me in this idea. But they all sat and looked at me, and eventually a lady in the front, I mean, everybody there was... I was in Edinburgh, so one was obliged to call those people ladies. Everybody there was of a certain Edinburgh set, if you can imagine. And she questions were offered to the floor, and she put her hand up and said, "You seem quite nice. Where did this, you know, where did this idea come from? Where did this story come from?" I said, "Well, you know," and I put off, you know, imagination, and you know, writers don't actually live through all the experiences they put on paper, or else, you know. And they just wouldn't have it. They wouldn't have it. And eventually somebody actually said, "But there's no smoke without fire."
that's very true.
Well, of course, but I wasn't going to advertise that.
Mm-hmm.
Since that book got a review, which was, the headline was, "He sleeps with his mother, but don't worry, he waits till she's dead." I think that was my favorite review, actually.
Well, you do indeed seem quite nice, sir. And there's no sales without publicity, and the books are for sale. The reason I stress this with the bookshop is because I actually think it's quite a good thing to have built up between these events and the bookshop, which is run as a terribly, terribly hard-nosed commercial activity. And while I'm at it, this book here, The Parent Trap, by Maureen Freely, who works for the Warwick Writing Programme, is due out in 3 weeks and is no doubt about to cause an incredible storm. Now, passing on for those adverts, and not to benight the spirit of the sacred that we've just been inhabiting, your questions, please. Maggie. When if I repeat the question? For the sake of the recording of these events, I repeat the question briefly. This is a question about the gestation between the writing and publishing of the poems. Is that a fair enough resume? No.
I don't actually feel that I write poetry in terms of composing it. What you said earlier about Mandelstam really resonated for me, because how I compose sounds grand, but you know. Is in my head mostly, and then I write it down on paper, either if it's a long poem in chunks that quite seem to naturally fit together, or sometimes the whole poem, because I'm paper. So the poem gets written, it's more like it's kind of finished then, and I don't really do any drafting, except the thing I do on paper is to restructure things on the page sometimes to make it look more, to prompt the reader more to read it the way I want them to hear it. Some poems get left around for a long time because I don't understand them. You know, I have some kind of idea of what they're about, but I feel as though there's not a logical line through the poem that's evident to me sometimes. So they get left around for a time. I always know if the title is right, I'll know that the line that runs through the poem is probably going to be all right as well. But I think it's quite okay just to leave things. Other things get, you know, good. I've sent stuff out to magazines and stuff when they've wanted stuff that is brand new, you know, literally I've just written it. But other things have just sat around for a while and then come out later. Sometimes things appear which have no kind of continuity with the other stuff I'm writing at the time, and I feel a bit suspicious of that. I think, well, where's that come from, and why is that there now? And sometimes that's become a seed of something else. So, you know, I tend to find that as a chunk of time I'm writing poems, that eventually it comes to a close and that starts to fall into being a collection of poems.
How closely do you work with your editor at Cape, with Robin?
Well, I mean, he's a good friend, and he never sees anything until it's finished. And I mean, I trust him. I think he trusts me quite well as well. I just send him a manuscript, and he'll make small but very crucial suggestions about things. But none less so now than perhaps we started. I think the most important thing is to get a good editor towards the start of your publishing career, as it were.
This idea of what was practice of composing poetry in the head was very natural and spontaneous. So how do you think about form? When you put
on
the
thing to say, you think about
the structure
of it. Mm.
Did you ever write
into
a particular form,
set yourself
apart,
or
anything like that?
I don't think about form. I think form is a little bit like kind of critiquing a poem as well. Form seems to me that emerges out of the process as opposed to being something that's kind of like a blueprint or laid over the process before anything happens. So I've written sonnets, I mean, not very many, but well, not many that I'm happy with. But the impulse to write hasn't been, oh, I think I'll wake up today and write a sonnet. It's been that something's been happening that begins to form itself into a sonnet. So it'll actually sometimes end up on the page with like the kind of structure of a sonnet, with, you know, like a missing rhyme or rhymes in different places, and that doesn't bother me too much. I'm not going to sit there and worry about that. And yet, and then eventually, because I know it's not right, but I don't know why it's not right, but I'm not saying, oh, it's not right because, you know, line, whatever doesn't rhyme with whatever or whatever it might be. But eventually it does work its way into something I recognize formally as a sonnet, say. And then, okay, one throws away a lot of work. I throw away quite a lot. But it comes back again, you know, and I don't think I've ever thrown anything away that didn't come back again and was slightly better for the experience, you know, slightly stronger in itself for the experience. So I think, I wouldn't sit down and say, right, I think, I'll, you know, there's a fashion for sonnets at the moment, so I'll go and write some sonnets, because I can't do that. I have people who can. And I'm not saying that my way of composing would be, say, you know, it's not my way anyway, but is necessarily a good one for other people. But it worked for me, and interestingly, I did try writing, and I was conscious of being a person writing as opposed to the processes that were happening. And I tried writing for a while and didn't like the results, because I wasn't letting it happen the way it seemed to happen naturally. It seems to happen more naturally now.
I don't mean this to sound bad, but maybe you're not afraid sometimes that you might be stuck in the form you've got in your head. You know, you just keep composing these things in your head, and you're not experimenting with different forms, you're forcing yourself, trying yourself to stretch and
things. I think, you know, I think of the poet who, for me more than anybody else, I read a poem of hers when I was very, well, when I was young, too young to understand it well, but Marian Moore wrote several great poems. For me, a handful of the best poems of the 20th century. And she was formally very inventive. I mean, there's a kind of British thing of not accepting certain forms because they don't correspond to things that happened in Britain before they were invented, as it were. But Marianne Moore invented new forms, you know, or created, what we want to say, new forms, which fit an American voice, in the same way, say, William Carlos Williams did. Now, what happened to Marianne Moore, it seems to me, was that she did this a handful of times with an amazing power and effectiveness and beauty and grace, you know? But I think the general perception of Marianne Moore is that she got kind of stuck. And that might be true. But Marianne Moore did two things which, for me, you know, would make her would still leave her as an important poet that I've benefited from. One was her formal inventiveness. Mm-hmm. And the other was that no matter how sometimes later on in their career, the poems got a little dry in places, the language always had something to offer. And also that she continued to address things that were difficult. You know, she wrote poetry which was philosophically demanding and intellectually demanding, but yet was sensual and often glittered and shone and stuff. And I feel as though, so you take the poem of hers, The Steeplejack, which has got a kind of surface simplicity, a surface unfamiliarity if you're used to more European forms, and a philosophical profundity in it, which is in no way pretentiously so. I mean, I'm not suggesting that she's, you know, breaking any new ground. I think poets, as philosophers, as it were, should do that. But take a poem like that, and I feel it's a challenge that we have to try to rise to continually as writers. So, I mean, you know, I've always got that poem in my mind, along with a few others, of poems that just put you in your place, you know?
Yeah, you're on record. I was reading today, talking about your influences of saying that you admire many of your contemporaries, and that you usually look to them for qualities I lack.
Mm.
which of your contemporaries do you go to for that storehouse?
Well, I think what happens is that there are contemporary poets that I like who fulfill something that because I can't do it, and I'm not working there, I just delight in their work because they're doing stuff. It's like, I could never write that kind of feeling of, you look at a poem by somebody who's, you know, roughly contemporary, you say, I could never write that poem. And I guess my best example would be Don Patterson in Scotland. I don't know if you know Don Patterson's work, but it's intellectually playful, it's inventive, it's the language is wonderful. But he does all kinds of things that I just couldn't even begin to think of. How did he do that? So someone like that might be a case. I find that the poets, that the contemporary poets that interest me most are mostly American and mostly women. And I don't know why that happens to be the case. But Linda Gregerson, Alison Funk, Bridget Beguine Kelly, and Jory Graham are four just twos out of the air. And often it's because they're approaching some of the things that I'm interested in, which is to do with the human relationship with nature, effectively. And I hate the word nature, but it's a kind of shorthand, okay? We'll all accept that the word nature, as I just used it, is shorthand for a whole bundle of difficult questions, yeah? But these writers are dealing with that bundle of difficult questions in ways that, again, I don't feel I could begin to deal with because of cultural things, because of, we'll use the word gender, but I mean, you know, all kinds of historical things that happened. And I can learn a huge amount from them about...
How does your gender debar you from writing architecturally magnificent explorations of natural history?
It doesn't. No, I mean, it's just the subtleties in the poems that the more you think about it, the more you realise arise out of ways in which we're conditioned to relate to the so-called natural world, of which we are, of course, a part. And there's a really, it's too long, it's too complicated for my mind anyway, in a sense, an answer in this. But if you take a poem like Reading Plato by Jory Graham, which is a really wonderful poem about that question, it seems to me that she approaches it really well in that poem, the whole question about the male experience and the female experience. And I think probably I'd be much happier using terms like yin and yang and what you want to call it, something that's more neutral. But there's no doubt about it that our society trains us to approach nature in different ways, or the natural world in different ways.
Well, I don't want to come across as some sort of poetic Mr. Motivator, but you have a mathematical background. You are a lyricist. It would strike me that you're perfectly placed to jump over that.
Yeah, I think I'm not saying that the male poet can't do that. I can't do it. I think many male poets do it very well, but I think it's also a cultural thing to do with Britishness, which don't get me started on that one. The whole question of British and the very British thing, and a certain British suspicion of some philosophical questions, and some kinds of lyricism too,
yes,
which also cause hindrances to approaching that, you know, that area.
Does anybody have any more questions for John?
Yeah, I was interested in the spirituality of poetry. So it seems to be this element of something beyond physical or kind of beneath it.
Mm.
In the Dunham House, it's like especially in terms of language. I just wondered if there was like any kind of guiding thoughts for your writing.
You mean a religious belief? Oh, sorry, you want to...
No. I'm just going to throw a quote in as well, which aligns with that. Where you once wrote, I was interested in the question of the real and with the ability of language to express the sense of the sacred, the natural world, and the cycles of decay and degeneration. The sense of the sacred that kind of shimmers behind everything that you do, which you might call a philosophy, a natural philosophy.
Shimmers in. I think what worries me about things like spiritual or mystical or terms like that is so often, especially again in our culture, it goes along with the view of somehow saying that the brightness, the light, or whatever, this quality is behind or obscured by the physical. And I think it's not, it's revealed by the physical, because there's no, I'm just anti-dualist, I suppose, to take a short, again, use shorthand. But I feel that we wouldn't be in the pickle we're in with regard to, some of the environmental issues that bother me, if we hadn't got bogged down in a way of thinking which somehow said that there was something spiritual that was separate from the physical, if you see what I mean. And, Greek philosophy and Christianity have a huge part to play in that, obviously, or Judeo-Christian thinking, and certain kinds of Greek philosophy, especially our friend Plato. And we've learned a lot from going out and looking at other cultures and other philosophies and seeing how they talk about those questions, yeah? And I think it's important to, I wouldn't write poetry at all, I don't think. I mean, I certainly wouldn't publish it at all if it was about my life, about me as a person. If it didn't occasionally seem to me that it was saying something about what I feel is, I mean, just immense kind of feeling of love and gratitude towards them in the very physical world around us. And nothing else, you know. To me, an angel is a metaphor for something, if you like. And I don't want to speak about God. But there's an informing force, which is the best piece of shorthand that I've found for it is Tao, the Chinese word, and the Chinese concept of it. But even that is just a concept, you know. And Meister Eckhart said, roughly, God, as a kind of prayer, God, save me from the idea of God. And, you know, I probably echo that prayer. Mm-hmm. And yet there's no doubt about it, there's something I'm trying to reach out for, which I feel as though everything that I was educated through and was made to be deprived me of, if you see what I mean.
Does anybody else have any further questions?
No, I hope it's not. No, I hope not. It sounds odd to say it in the same breath as what I was just saying before, but I don't see any difference between writing poetry and, say, the best science, or philosophy for that matter. And what I'm interested in isn't me, it's the world, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to sound falsely modest or anything, I've got the same ego as everybody else here, but I'm not really interested in me. It's not of any interest whatsoever. I don't think there's anything special about me, you know? I think another thing that I remember treasuring when I heard it was somebody asked the poet Michael Longley when he knew a poem was finished. And he said, when I'm not in it anymore, mm-hmm. you know? And it seems to me that what he's saying was, the poem that gets finished, that gets published, is like sending a gift or a letter to somebody who becomes, you know, is the reader who receives it, as it were. And it's saying, I'm taking myself out of this room so that you can inhabit it the way you want to and don't have me dictate to you how you should live there. And my hang-ups and problems and neuroses and all the rest of it just aren't very useful to you as furniture in that poem. So, you know, I hope it's not about me ever, really, in that sense, mm-hmm. as far as possible.
For the past few days, as is a tradition here at the university, we have a thing called the Poem for the Week. And the Poem for the Week, completely flying in the face of copyright laws, was in fact Snake, by John Burnside. However, I managed to pull it off the CAPE website, so it could be said to be in the public domain.
Great,
could you possibly finish the reading by reading
yes.
that for us? And then we'll say thank you and goodbye.
Okay. Snake. As cats bring their smiling mouse kills and hypnotized birds, slinking home under the light of a summer's morning to offer the gift of a corpse, you carry home the snake you thought was sunning itself on a rock at the river's edge. Sun-fretted, gracile, it shimmies and sways in your hands like a muscle of light, and you gather it up like a braid for my admiration. I can't shake the old wife's tale that snakes never die. They hang in a seamless dream of frog skin and water, preserving a ribbon of heat in a bone or a vein, a cold-blooded creature's promise of resurrection. And I'm amazed to see you shuffle off the woman I've known for years, tracing the lithe, hard body, the hinge of the jaw, the tension where sex might be, as I always assume is neuter, when I walk our muffled house at nightfall, throwing switches, locking doors.
Thanks, John.